Let's take each of these points one after the other and see the kind of evidences that are present for them. If you want to get this sort of material in a good deal of detail, I suggest the two books that are back there on the table, The Shape of the Past and Where is History Going? The Shape of the Past and Where is History Going? We're not going to be able to go into that degree of detail here, but we're going to try to put this into a sufficient perspective that you'll be able to use it when you discuss these matters. All right, we start out with the reliability of the gospel documents. In order to show that a document is sound, any old document, there are three basic tests: the bibliographical test, the internal test, and the external test. Bibliographical, internal, external. The bibliographical test means whether the document has gotten to us successfully. That is, whether through the copying and recopying prior to the invention of printing, the document has successfully survived this and actually represents what was first written. Let's say, for example, you find a document of the 15th century, a handwritten document, which says that Julius Caesar wore red underwear. You check to see where this document came from, and you discover that it comes from a long line of documents. And as you go back through these documents, you find that some of them say he wears purple underwear, others green underwear, others striped underwear, and so forth. In other words, as you check the various documents back through time, you'll be darned if you can determine what the original document said. The documents are too diverse in their assertions. Now, in a situation like that, you can't do very much with the document. The textual tradition is too weak. Now, in the case of the gospel materials, we have the best bibliographical situation for any documents of the ancient world, the very best. This is what Sir Frederick Kenyon has to say on the subject, and you are able to consult the Kenyon quotation yourself. Sir Frederick Kenyon had this to say back in 1933, before many of the papyrus fragments that we presently have were discovered. Said Kenyon, "All this repeated mention of divergent manuscripts and families of texts may perhaps give the impression that the text of the New Testament is abnormally uncertain." In other words, because there's so many manuscripts, you may get the idea that you have an uncertain text. "Such an impression can best be corrected by an attempt to envisage the early history of the text and its present condition. So far from the New Testament text being in an abnormally unsatisfactory state, it is far better attested than that of any other work of ancient literature. Its problems and difficulties arise not from a deficiency of evidence, but from an excess of it." In other words, we've got such a tremendous amount of strong texts that we are embarrassed by the riches of them. Our trouble comes from too much stuff rather than too little. Here is a comparative situation. Do you know that the distance separating the writing of Plato's dialogues from the first complete texts of the dialogues is 1,300 years? 1,300 years! In the case of the New Testament materials, the distance is, without benefit of later papyrus discoveries, about 300 years. You can check in any work of classical textual criticism to see that practically all the knowledge we have of Greco-Roman antiquity comes from manuscripts where the earliest complete texts are separated from the events by a simply gigantic period of time. It's true that you have some quotations and you have excerpts and so forth in the intermediate period, but you don't get the complete texts, generally speaking, until the texts are discovered in the Italian Renaissance, of the 14th, 15th, 16th centuries. And these texts turn out not to be ancient writings, but they turn out to be materials that are separated from the original writing by a tremendous length of time. I majored in classics and philosophy as an undergraduate at Cornell, and we went through Plato's Apology of Socrates in the Greek until we were blue in the face. We exegeted that stuff from stem to stern. We analyzed each bloomin' genitive absolute that turned up, and so on. And I never remember one of my classics professors pointing out that the text we were going at in that detail was actually a text 1,300 years after the original writer had presented it. What could have happened in the 1,300 years? A tremendous number of things, and yet the assumption was that accurate copying would have taken place. In the case of the New Testament documents, you've got a period of 300 years without counting the quotations, the selections, the lectionary readings, the papyrus fragments, and that sort of thing, which now, today, so bridge that period that you could practically reconstruct the entire gospel content just from those things. You know, we have fragments of the Gospel of John that have to be dated at the very end of the first century, the very beginning of the second century. In other words, within just a few years of the time that John claimed to have written that gospel. And those fragments were found in Egypt, you know, so they had to get from Ephesus, where John died, over to Egypt some way. That certainly would have taken some time. We have, in other words, some materials that press right back onto the time of writing itself. Indeed, Sir Frederick Kenyon, just before his death in the 1940s, made an even stronger statement than this, and it's included in Where is History Going? Or in History and Christianity, and the statement was this, that now, in light of new discoveries, any questions as to the authenticity or general integrity of the New Testament materials are finally removed. He underscores authenticity and general integrity. And Kenyon was the greatest authority in this field this generation. Kenyon was principal librarian of the British Museum. When I had a little set to with Mrs. O'Hare on TV, on radio in Chicago 10 years ago or so, I tried to quote Kenyon, finally succeeded in quoting him, but all the time I was quoting him, Mrs. O'Hare was saying, "Was he a Christian? Was he a Christian?" And so I said, "Well, I really don't know, but he didn't become principal librarian of the British Museum by going to catechism class. It had nothing to do whatever with the question of whether he was a Christian or not. Either he was competent in this field or he wasn't, and he is regarded as the foremost specialist in this area." All right. Bibliographically, then, the New Testament is in great shape. And just a little footnote to that, you may wonder why most Bible translations are almost identical, even if they're early or late. Isn't it frustrating to pay $6.50 for the latest translation, hot off the press, and find that about 99.44% of it is King James or very close to it? Why is that? It's because all the texts are so good. You see, the King James Bible was translated from Erasmus' Greek text of the New Testament. That was the first printed edition of the Greek New Testament, done in 1516, Erasmus Novum Instrumentum. And Erasmus went around to monasteries. You can imagine this, Erasmus pounding on the door of the monastery, waking up the sleeping monks, getting them back to a fair degree of sobriety. This is no exaggeration, because he also wrote The Praise of Folly, in which he described the way in which monks lived in those days. Well, he managed to snap the monk back into a fair degree of consciousness, and he goes in and he looks at the manuscripts in the monastery. And when he sees a manuscript that looks quite old of the New Testament, he says, "Ah, an old one." When he sees one that doesn't look quite as old, superficially, he says, "Ah, one not quite as old." And he does his Greek testament on the basis of that sort of thing. Really a very primitive kind of manuscript examination. He didn't have the benefit of modern scientific techniques for dating manuscripts. All right, he prepares his critical text. The King James translators translated into English. Luther translates it into German as the standard edition in German. And those translations become normative up until the end of the 19th century. End of the 19th century, in Germany, Tischendorf, and in England, Westcott and Hort, begin careful scientific examination of the dates of early manuscripts. They prepare a critical text which is immensely more sophisticated than anything Erasmus did. And then the revisers revise the King James, the English Revised Version is produced, the American Revised Version, and then later on the Revised Standard Version and the modern versions we know. And isn't it strange? When all of that work has been done, the result is almost exactly the same as it was three centuries earlier. Why? Because Erasmus could hardly go wrong. All of the texts were that good. You see? The texts were so good, the textual tradition was so strong, that he could hardly miss in providing a reliable text as a basis for reliable translations. So, bibliographically, the New Testament is in super great shape. If you don't like it, you don't have to like it, but then you've got to dislike all of what you encounter outside of it in the classical world. I had a debate up at the University of British Columbia a number of years ago, and I argued this way, that if you're going to dump the New Testament documents, you can do it, but first you've got to dump your knowledge of the classical world. And the professor I had the debate with said, "All right, I'll dump my knowledge of the classical world." And a colleague jumped up and said, "Good Lord, George, not that." I mean, you know, recognizing that surely that wasn't the answer. But if the materials you use for your knowledge of the classical world are less adequate bibliographically than the New Testament, what else could you do? See, again, our fundamental technique, use the same techniques you have to employ outside of the Christian questions and apply them to Christian questions, and you find that the answers come up in favor of the Christian position. All right, what about internal evidence? Internal evidence means whether the documents claim to have been written by eyewitnesses or by associates of eyewitnesses, whether, in other words, they claim to be primary source material. Let us say that you are working with your manuscript having to do with Julius Caesar wearing red underwear. And in this case, you have a good textual tradition, all right? But as you read the document, it finally, at the bottom of it, it says, "In case you are wondering who is writing this, I am Alfonso, a Spanish plumber of the 14th century." Now, if you come across that, even though the textual tradition is very strong, even though you feel that as Alfonso wrote it, so you have it, you're not going to be very impressed, because Alfonso is not going to be the very best person to inform you as to the tonsorial habits of Julius Caesar. On the other hand, if it is signed Marcus, chief underwear purchaser to Julius Caesar, or something of that sort, you at least have internal reason to think that this stuff is of value. In the case of the New Testament documents, the claims are, by the writers, that they actually had contact with the events themselves, or at worst, knew people who did and checked it out. Peter, for example, says, "We have not followed cunningly devised fables." The Greek word there is mouthoi, myths. "We have not followed cunningly devised myths when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. We were eyewitnesses of his majesty." The Gospel of John, which many people try to put in the category of a late theological interpretation rather than a factual presentation of Jesus' life, the writer of the Gospel of John says over and over again, "I saw, I heard, I touched," that which we have seen and heard and touched and handled. The empirical language of the Gospel of John is one of the most striking characteristics of the book. The book begins with a word made flesh, "and we beheld him, glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." The idea of Jesus coming right down into our midst so that we could have tactile contact with him. And it ends with doubting Thomas. The climax event of the Gospel of John, prior to the epilogue chapter, is doubting Thomas. And what does Thomas say? Until I can see the nail prints, until I can thrust my hand into his side, I will not believe. And Jesus satisfies those conditions. Now, the whole point of this is that this was empirical. It was within our frame of reference. We actually had that kind of contact. At very worst, if you can call it that, you have the preface to the Gospel of Luke. Scholars have compared the first four verses of Luke with Herodotus and Thucydides and the great Greek historians, because Luke begins and he says, Theophilus, many have been attempting to set forth an account of the things that have happened among us with reference to Jesus, so that you may know the certainty of what occurred. I followed all things closely from the beginning, and I am setting this out in order. He says that he has consulted those people who have written about Jesus, and he has carefully filtered the material so as to give Theophilus what we would call the straight scoop. And that kind of information, therefore, is being presented as a direct account of what Jesus actually did. All right, the documents then claim to have been written by people who really had contact with the events. But of course, there's always a possibility that whoever wrote the documents could be lying, eh? And that they didn't really have contact with the events at all. Therefore, external evidence is also important. You want to see if there are data outside of the documents that confirm the claims that the documents make. You want to see if there are other people outside of the writers who confirm that these documents really did arise that way. And in the case of the New Testament, again, we are in a powerfully advantageous situation. Let me give you two very striking examples of this. We have the accounts of two people who were students of the Apostle John. And they say that John told them that he wrote the gospel that bears his name, and that Matthew was written by Matthew, and Mark was written by Mark, and Luke was written by Luke. In other words, that the gospels were written by the authors to whom they had been traditionally ascribed. That the author of Matthew was the tax collector, who was the apostle. That the author of Mark's gospel was John Mark, who was an associate of Peter. And that Luke's gospel was written by the physician who accompanied St. Paul on his missionary journeys. Who are these students? Well, one of them is Polycarp of Smyrna. Polycarp of Smyrna. As everybody knows, Smyrna is the present city of Izmir in eastern Turkey. That's widely known. You can ask anybody on the street. They'll immediately identify Smyrna. Anyway, Polycarp of Smyrna was a student of John and says John told him that. Also, Papias, P-I-P-I-A-S, Papias, Bishop of Hierapolis, says the same thing. And he says this independently. He wasn't cribbing from Polycarp, nor Polycarp from Papias. In case you're wondering where to find those quotations, Polycarp is presented. Polycarp's assertions to this effect are presented by the greatest of and most reliable of the early theologians of the church, Irenaeus. Irenaeus, the theologian Irenaeus, 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 who lived in the 3rd century. There is no church father more important or more reliable than he. And the statements that Papias makes are given to us by the greatest early historian of the church, Eusebius. E-U-S-E-B-I-U-S. That's Eusebius of Caesarea, but there weren't a vast number of Eusebii wandering around, so just Eusebius will do the trick there. And he was early 4th century at the time of the Council of Nicaea, time of Constantine the Great, in this sign we shall conquer and so forth. All right, so you can draw lines if you want to. You've got John, and then the evidence that John gives is presented to Polycarp, And Polycarp's statements on this subject are provided for us by Irenaeus. Then the same statements independently are given by Papias about John, and Papias' statements are presented to us, recorded for us by Eusebius. This is a tremendously strong evidential chain, and the evidential chain is very, very good because, for example, we can see now that when Eusebius quotes Papias, he does it accurately because we now have some independent texts of Papias that don't come through Eusebius. We can see that Eusebius is not in any way altering or messing around with the assertions that Papias made. Here's another line of external evidence which is interesting. There is very strong evidence to the effect that Peter and Paul died in the Neronian persecution in the year 64. Now, the book of Acts is principally an account of Paul's missionary journeys. Agreed? It is a kind of account of the life work of Paul. Now, if you're going to write a biography of somebody, if you're going to present an account of a person's work, and the person has died before you write, are you going to mention his death? Natch! Death is a fairly significant item in the life of a person, and if he's already died, you're going to mention he's died. But the book of Acts does not include any mention of Paul's death. Paul is left in Rome, going to Rome, and nothing is said about his dying. So, there is a powerful reason to hold that the book of Acts was written before 64, before Paul died at Rome. But Luke is part one of Acts. Even people who have some doubts about who wrote Luke and Acts hold that they were both written by the same person. They're both addressed to Theophilus. They both have the same vocabulary and so forth. All right. Luke, therefore, is written before Acts. It's part one of Acts. But also, most people agree today, most scholars, that Luke relied in part on Mark. Mark is one of the sources for Matthew and Luke. Now notice what's happening here. 64, the terminus. Prior to 64, the book of Acts. Prior to that, Luke. Prior to that, Mark. But Jesus died in the year 30, approximately. In other words, these writings are pushing right back on top of the life of Christ himself. In other words, they confirm nicely the claims of the documents that they were written by eyewitnesses. They confirm the kind of external evidence of authorship that we have from Polycarp and from Papias. Now, the upshot of all of this is that these documents are in super good condition on all three counts, bibliographical, external, and internal. But you say, I have gotten the impression that theologians today don't consider them all that good. I've heard of something that is called higher criticism. And higher criticism seems to say that these documents are really not very reliable. That's right. The higher critics do assert that these documents are not reliable. And the principle of higher criticism is the following. It says that the early church edited the materials about Jesus, and the results, as we have them today, don't necessarily reflect the actual life of Jesus. What they reflect is the faith experience of the early church. In other words, a Christian community had a certain view of its own faith experience. And that early community did a biography of Jesus, if we could even use that term, did a writing concerning Jesus, which made Jesus reflect the early church's faith experience. And therefore, you get different accounts because they were different churches with different faith experiences. The whole idea being that the Gospels as we have them are not primary and original. The Gospels as we have them are the product of editing. All right? And fragmentary materials were put together, and the early church determined the results. And so you can't rely upon the historicity of this stuff. What's the trouble with that? Well, there are several problems with it, but the most important difficulty is that there wasn't time to do it. There wasn't time to do it. We've already seen that these documents press right back onto the time of Christ himself. And they were in circulation. Notice this. They were in circulation while hostile witnesses were still alive as to Jesus' career. You see, Jesus' life was not a matter of indifference to people. People got very excited about Jesus' life, particularly the Jewish religious community, because the religious community of the Jews recognized that if Jesus actually was the person he claimed to be, it would mean the end of historic Judaism. So the Jewish religious leaders had every reason to destroy early Christianity or to show that early Christianity was off base. What would have been easier than to point out that the very books being circulated by the early church and the very preaching that the early church carried on didn't actually reflect who Jesus was? Naturally, when the early Christians went to the synagogues, and that's what they did, they went right to the synagogues to hit the opposition right at the center, naturally, the religious leaders would have said, I was in Jerusalem at the time of the Passover when all of that happened. You can't pull that. Jesus wasn't like that at all. Why, you've turned him into a reflection of yourselves. But we get none of that. None of those who had every reason to say that did say it. There was no attempt to refute the accounts as they were circulating, and those accounts are the ones that we have today. Another point. The higher critics call themselves documentary critics. That is, it sounds as if they're dealing with documents. Well, in one sense, they are. But what they're dealing with are documents that have been given to them by the textual critics. The textual critics analyze the documents bibliographically, as we've said, and they get down to the earliest texts that they can. All right. At this point, the higher critic sits down with the document, and he begins reading it. He sees what appears to him to be an inconsistency, or a lapse in style, or a change in vocabulary, and he says, aha, obviously this document is an edited document which was originally different. There were sub-documents that we don't any longer have, and those documents were pasted together rather badly by early church editors. The only way he makes this decision is by a subjective analysis of the complete document, saying to himself, that doesn't seem like it would have been originally. Well, that's quite a doubtful method of operation. And I refer you to an essay by C.S. Lewis. The essay is entitled Biblical Criticism, and it's included in C.S. Lewis' posthumous Christian Reflections. Lewis says this. He says, people have tried this on me. Reviewers have taken my books and they have tried to find out what writings went into them, what the sub-materials were. He says, you'd think that they would have succeeded once in a while, but they never have succeeded once. Not even by chance have they hit it. Now, he says, if that's the situation with them, operating in my own time scheme, in the present, what gives people the idea that they can go back 2,000 years and figure out what documents must have underlay documents that have come to them? My goodness, that's an alien language. It's an alien culture. How do they think they can manage this? Let me give you an illustration of the sort of thing that shows the intellectual difficulties with this method. A few years ago, two New Testament scholars by the names of McGregor and Morton did a computer analysis of St. Paul's letters. They took Romans and Galatians, which everybody agrees were written by Paul, and they fed the style of Romans and Galatians into a computer. Okay? They established a stylistic standard of comparison. Then they fed the other Pauline letters, so-called Pauline letters, into the computer to see if the styles compared adequately. The conclusion was that 6 or 7 people had written these letters. They were not written by one person. Then, some people at Harvard took McGregor and Morton's book on the subject, fed the style of the preface and first chapter into a computer, and checked the other chapters against it and showed that 5 people had written their book. Now you see the point of this. The assumption is fallacious that there needs to be a single and consistent style. Just as the assumption is fallacious that if you read a book and the transitions are not the way you would do them, or the shifts in argument are different from the way you would have done them, that couldn't have been an original document. The fact is that there are lots of different ways you can write a book. There are lots of different styles you can use. You can change vocabulary rapidly. This is no certain proof of authorship at all. Take your love letters and compare them with your term papers. Huh? There's a considerable difference. The Gospel of John is written in a careful, deliberate, planned way. The author says at the end of chapter 20 that if he'd put down all the things that Jesus did, the world couldn't contain the books. But he says, these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, and believing you might have life through his name. There's a definite principle of selection. The author selects carefully according to this principle, and that's the result. The style is a direct and formal style. The Revelation of John, the last book of the Bible, is not at all that way. There are sentences left hanging in air. The writer is going at tremendous speed. It's obvious that he is attempting to cram onto papyrus things that he can hardly understand. What's the difference? The difference is that he was on the island of Patmos on the Lord's day and he got zapped by the Spirit. The Spirit hit him over the head and said, write, and bam, he writes, and he goes like blue blazes. Now, of course the style is different, of course the vocabulary is different, but that doesn't mean anything. And yet, probably 90% of contemporary New Testament scholars claim that the Revelation of St. John could not have been written by the same person as the Gospel of John. The trouble with these higher critical arguments is not particularly theological. The trouble is intellectual. This is bad scholarship. It is messy, 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 messy scholarship. And it should be rejected on that ground. We just don't know enough about the interior life of a writer 2,000 years ago to conclude that he couldn't have written a book in a particular way. We've got to stop with the best complete text that we have and not engage in speculation that cuts back behind that. Such speculation gives no certain results at all. In fact, this method was tried in other fields and was found wanting. In the field of classics, this was tried in reference to Homer's Odyssey in the 19th century. I had a professor who was quite a wag, Harry Kaplan, a fine classicist, and Kaplan said, you know, we tried to get at the real sources of the Odyssey, the sub-documents through the 19th century, and we never could agree as to which ones they were. Nobody could agree as to where one source stopped and the other began. And so we concluded finally that if the Odyssey was not written by Homer, it was written by someone of the same name who lived about the same time. The people who are continuing this kind of nonsense are people in the biblical field. And the reason for this is various, but I suppose one strong reason is that people in the theological field, if they are not conservative, historical, Christian believers, idolize and deify their method. And therefore, they hang on to their method until the last dog is hung. The method is more important than anything else, and so the method stays no matter what. Another thing that helps, of course, is that these people only have contact with each other. It's sort of a mutual back scratching. They all go to the Society for Biblical Literature and Exegesis each year, and they engage in mutual back scratching. At the University of Chicago, when I was on the faculty of the Divinity School, and the head of the library there, of the University of Chicago Divinity School Library, I had lots of contacts with other departments of the university. And I found that the other departments of the university thought that the liberal biblical scholars in the Divinity School were nuts, that they were really boobies. The people in the literature department wouldn't even have contact with the people who were engaged in the biblical interpretation in the Divinity School, because they said these people were lame-brain subjectivists, that they just messed around with texts without relying on the manuscript materials as the final authority. Elder Olson and other people in the literature department had been working for years to get away from an existential approach to the interpretation of Shakespeare, so that people would look at what Shakespeare wrote and simply take it and try to understand it. And then over in the Divinity School, there were people who were trying to find all of the sources and subsources with no documents as a basis for it. So when you're dealing with higher criticism, please, don't think that you're dealing with a scholarly area. You really are not. You're dealing with an area of speculation, or better, the technical term is conjecture. This is an area of conjecture. And conjecture is a very dangerous kind of practice. All right. If these documents are sound, what do they say, pray tell? Well, we don't need to spend a great deal of time on this. We would need to spend time on it if we were operating 30 years ago or 40 years ago, during the period of Protestant liberalism, when an attempt was made to find a simple Jesus, so-called, a simple Jesus, a humanistic Jesus in the New Testament. But I'm sure you realize that there is no possibility of doing this at all. The attempt to do this was destroyed finally by Albert Schweitzer. You know, in the 19th century, people did Life and Times of Jesus biographies, and Jesus turned out to be a typical evolutionary product of the 19th century, and the miracles were pushed aside, and the emphasis was placed on the moral teachings of Jesus, and so on. And Schweitzer came along in the quest of the historical Jesus, and Schweitzer said, "This man, according to the documents, thought he was coming on the clouds of heaven with all the heavenly host." At the crucial point in his trial, when he was asked whether he was the Messiah, he said, you've said this correctly, you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with all the heavenly host. The Son of Man there is a reference to Daniel 7:13, one of the high apocalyptic passages of the Old Testament concerning God coming to earth to clean up history. Now, says Schweitzer, that's what he thought. Of course, he was wrong. He wasn't that. He was just an ordinary man. But he really thought he was that kind of person. And Schweitzer did a medical dissertation at Strasbourg entitled "A Psychiatric Examination of Jesus," in which Schweitzer endeavored to show that Jesus, even though he thought that he was the apocalyptic Son of Man, God come to earth to clean up history, and wasn't, was nevertheless sane. And that was quite a job. That's been translated into English with a preface by Overholser, past president of the American Psychiatric Association. Overholser says, Schweitzer was really not successful here. I've known religious nuts who have ideas like that, and this really isn't very successful. But the point is that Schweitzer showed that if you take the data, you do find Jesus making claims like that. Those claims run all the way through the New Testament, and there's no way to get away from it. In other words, you can't have a simple humanistic Jesus. You have a choice. You either have Jesus who is God Almighty, or a nut, a person who really thought he was God but wasn't. If you only had the Gospel according to St. Mark, the earliest of the Gospels apparently, if you only had that, that would be enough to show you the kind of picture that Jesus had of himself. Take Mark 2, the healing of the paralytic. paralytic let down through the roof. Jesus says, your sins be forgiven. The scribes and the Pharisees start mumbling. Who can forgive sin but God only? Jesus doesn't say, oops, you're quite right, it was a slip of the tongue. I surely didn't mean that I can forgive sin. All I mean is that I'm here to proclaim that your Father in heaven forgives sin, or something like that. Instead, the text says, but that you may know that the Son of Man has power to forgive sins, he says to the paralytic, take up your bed and walk. Paralytic takes up the bed. People conclude that Jesus has forgiven his sins, and they glorify God. And there again, the expression Son of Man is used, that you may note the Son of Man has power on earth to forgive sins. No Orthodox Jew could hear that phrase without knowing what was being claimed there. And remember, Jesus ends up charged with blasphemy and crucified on the charge of blasphemy because the people who heard him recognized that he was claiming deity and nothing less than deity. We commented on the passage the first night where Philip says, show us the Father. Jesus says, have I been so long with you and you have not known me? He who has seen me has seen the Father. And this stuff is being written by Orthodox Jews, for goodness sake, who maintain monotheism. I mean, obviously, they wouldn't have put that kind of thing in Jesus' mouth. That's the last thing they would have put in Jesus' mouth. All right. So in these reliable historical records, Jesus claims to be God. The simple question is, was he God or wasn't he? He says, one sign will be given to this wicked and perverse generation, the sign of Jonah. I will be in the earth and I will rise again. Tear down this temple and in 3 days I will build it again. He claims that he's going to die and rise again. According to the accounts, that's exactly what he did. And those accounts are described in the most minute detail. This is not a mass hypnosis kind of nonsense or anything like it. This is a case of Jesus having been crucified, stone dead, and then subsequently during a 40-day period, he is seen again and again in the most intimate kind of situations where direct, tangible, empirical proof is possible. Doubting Thomas, we've already mentioned that. The disciples are back to the fishing nets, you know, back to the old trade because they are so discouraged and miserable after the death of Christ, and he comes along the shore. And the text says in Luke, they thought that they saw a ghost. And he said, does a ghost have flesh and bone as you see that I do? Do you have anything here to eat? And they give him a fish and he eats it before them. Now, surely accounts like that are direct and straightforward accounts of what these people claimed to have seen. If you say anything else, you say they were a sneaky bunch who were just trying to overcome the sort of suspicions that had been expressed. In other words, they said, we think we're seeing a ghost because they wanted you to feel that they first thought that and then they later came to the conclusion that this was really Jesus. But you don't get the impression of them as being sort of James Bond-ish in their approach to matters. They are very direct, and it's unthinkable that they were setting up a thing like this in order to trick anybody. And it's also inconceivable that these hard-headed people in so many different areas of life would have been deceived by that sort of thing. How exactly would such a deception have gone on during a 3-year ministry where miracle after miracle is recorded and where the resurrection is given in the kind of detail indicated? Also remember that this stuff was circulating while hostile witnesses were alive, who certainly would have blown the whistle if the stuff hadn't turned out to be accurate. The upshot of this is that if you don't go along with Jesus' claim to deity on the basis of the resurrection, you simply can't handle this material. Think about it for a minute. You've got to explain the body somewhere, some way, right? Something has got to be done with that problem after the crucifixion. Now, there are only 3 interest groups in the situation. They're the Romans, they're the Jewish religious leaders, and they're the disciples. If Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then one of those groups must have made off with the body. The Romans certainly didn't. The Romans wanted to keep it quiet in Palestine at all cost. That was the reason why Pilate jeopardized his very soul in allowing Jesus to be crucified. The Jewish religious leaders were the last ones to want to have the body taken. They're the ones who asked to have the stone put there in front of the tomb and the guard to prevent any rumors from starting about this. And if the disciples took the body, then they would have gone out and intentionally died for what they knew to be untrue. I grant you that people have died for a lot of crazy things in the course of history, and dying for something doesn't make it true. But it's one thing to die for something that you think is true and isn't, and another thing to die for something you know isn't true. And they would have had to die for something they knew wasn't true if they themselves had been responsible in some sense for getting rid of the body. Now, of course, there are other explanations offered for this. There is the Passover plot theory, and there is the Chariot of the Gods type of explanation. And I will just comment quickly on those. The Passover plot theory is that Jesus only swooned in the tomb. This is a variation of the 18th century swoon theory of Venturini, a German rationalist. And according to this theory, Jesus didn't die on the cross. He woke in the tomb in a much weakened condition, and he remained alive just long enough to give people the idea he rose again from the dead. Now, if you can believe that, you should have no trouble with the resurrection. That's about the best way to put it. If you can actually go along with that kind of thing, the resurrection shouldn't bother you in the slightest. Because in order to accept a theory like that, you first of all got to hold that the crucifixion team didn't know its business. But they had a great deal of practice. The Appian Way was lined with crosses. It was a hideous and common method of punishment, and the description of it medically has led medical observers to say that Jesus most definitely died. There was a puncturing of the lymphatic sac around the heart, and this is why blood and water came out and so forth. Secondly, what happened to Jesus after he did die? You've got the same problem. And unless he did all the things mentioned during the 40 days, surely it doesn't help you to account for all of those observations of the resurrected Christ, including ascending into heaven, which is very difficult for a weakened person after hours on the cross, to say nothing about a healthy one, you see. It's very, very difficult to do that. So that doesn't seem to work. The Chariot of the Gods, Fandanikan, type of view is really this, that Jesus did do something like this, but he was a spaceman. He was a man from outer space who had knowledge and abilities that go beyond that of ordinary human beings. And that was how he managed to do it. Now, of course, in order for such a theory to be sustained, it's necessary for Jesus to have been, for the spaceman to have been so cleverly disguised as Jesus that nobody knew that he wasn't, right? But in that case, how do you know he was? In other words, clearly the disguising of the spaceman was perfect. It was so perfect that everybody really thought that he was Jesus. But then now, 2,000 years later, we say he's a spaceman. It's possible, I agree. But then again, it's possible that Fandanikan is a spaceman, so cleverly disguised as Fandanikan that nobody can tell the difference. Or that I am a spaceman, disguised in a Montgomery suit, so cleverly worked out that nobody can tell the difference. Or you or your neighbor. If you begin to consider that kind of possibility, you will go stark staring mad. You cannot attempt to understand the world by possibilities. You can only understand the world by plausibilities. And plausibilities are those explanations that have some relation to the data. Actually, the Fandanikan bit is a technically meaningless argument in the category that we began with this evening. Why? Because no evidence can count against it. How can you argue against a position like that? Fandanikan says Jesus was perfectly the picture that you get in the New Testament, huh? And nobody thought that he was anything but that. So no matter what you say about the effectiveness of that portrait, Van Daniken will say, yes, 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 there isn't any way that you could possibly refute the position that he sets forth. All right. The conclusion to this is that Jesus did in fact rise from the dead. And that in turn evidences his claim for deity. There's just one other little matter that I want to mention here, and that is the question, which sometimes arises, though not very often, as to whether Jesus would necessarily have been God even rising from the dead. The question is put like this: just because he rose from the dead, does that mean he has to be God? Relatively few people raise this because, you know, you have sort of a sneaking suspicion that if he rose from the dead, you're really facing something pretty tremendous here, man, and you really got to do something with this, and you can't just dismiss it. But occasionally you will get a person who says, you mean to tell me that just because he performed a miracle, I'm supposed to accept him as God? Let me suggest an answer to this. It's quite true that the performance of any old miracle would not necessarily lead to the affirmation of deity. For example, let's say that I come here to Santa Barbara and I get off the plane, I have a long white robe on and a beard. And when the lectures begin, I say, now, one thing that wasn't put in the preliminary announcements is this: I am God. And you say, yeah? And I say, yeah. And to demonstrate this, I am going to grow hair on a billiard ball. I produce a billiard ball from under my robe, and I go, bam! And bushy hair sprouts on the billiard ball. Now, I doubt very much that this would result in a general religious conversion. I don't think that that would be the result. The reason being that, though this might genuinely be a miracle, it would not exactly reach the depths of the human condition. I mean, it's not quite the sort of thing that meets man at his point of existential need. It isn't the sort of thing that changes lives, you see? It changes billiard balls, but it doesn't necessarily change lives. And thus, we have to say that though all miracles are equal, some are more equal than others. And the point of affirming Jesus' deity relative to the resurrection is that death is an overarching human problem. It may be the most basic human problem. Our psychoanalytic friends point out that everybody is far more concerned with his own death and the death of others than he's willing to admit. This is a common experience, that we think of our own death and are concerned with our own death to a far greater extent than we're willing to admit even to ourselves. This is part of our unconscious life. It is vital to our whole understanding of ourselves. The existentialists, such as Jean-Paul Sartre, stress that death is the most important event of life and is recognized as such. Under these circumstances, if somebody comes along and he says, I can conquer this, and I'm going to conquer it for you, and he goes ahead and does it, let's put it this way. If there's ever reason for worship, it's right there. If there were anything that anybody could do that would warrant worship, that would certainly be the thing. So a genuine resurrection does impel this kind of belief, whereas we admit that there are miracles that would not do this. If Jesus had only cursed the fig tree, for example, then it would be very difficult to argue this kind of claim. But it wasn't just that sort of thing at all. I had a discussion with a professor of philosophy at Roosevelt University some years ago, and after I finished talking about the resurrection, he said, I don't see why you have to get so excited about death. Death is like pattern baldness. That, by the way, was the origin of my billiard ball story, which I developed subsequently because I thought that that would tie in very nicely. But the professor said, death is like pattern baldness. I said, all right. While we're speaking, the faculty secretary comes to the door, and she is gray and shaken. And she says, Professor, I don't know how to tell you this, but we've just received a call from the Chicago police. Your wife and your three children have been killed in an automobile accident in the loop. And you say, think nothing of it, sec. It's just like pattern baldness. And you go on with your lecture. Now, my reason for putting it that way was, of course, that nobody who is honest with himself can relegate death to that category. You can make the propositional assertion, of course, that after all, death is perfectly natural, and so forth. But we all know that it isn't that kind of thing. It's something far more significant than that, and it's something that we can't dismiss that way. And if you can't dismiss death that way, you can't dismiss a resurrection that way. You know, we don't know why anybody dies. Biologically, death is inexplicable. You can keep a virus alive indefinitely. Dying from old age is simply an appeal to ignorance. It's an asylum of ignorance. It's like the old technique in psychology of calling anything an instinct that you didn't understand. We don't know why people die from a biological standpoint. It is the ultimate horror and the ultimately inexplicable, absurd situation. And Jesus comes along and he says, I will deal with this. And I'll deal with it not only for me, I'll deal with it for you. And under those circumstances, it's essential to pay attention. If you don't pay attention there, then you've made the maximal mistake because you lose at the point of your greatest need.